Side 5.
It is I who am asking you, mademoiselle.
She sighed, was lost a minute in thought. Then, as though rousing herself, she said,
Those words had a meaning, monsieur, but not one that I can tell you. I can only give you my solemn word of honour that I had never set eyes on this man Ratchet in my life until I saw him on this train.
And you refuse to explain those words?
Yes, if you like to put it that way, I refuse. They had to do with a task I had undertaken.
Oh, a task that is now ended?
What do you mean?
It is ended, is it not?
Well, why should you think so?
Listen, mademoiselle, I will recall to you another incident. There was a delay to the train on the day we were to reach Stamboul. You are very agitated, mademoiselle. You, so calm, so self-controlled, huh? You lost that calm.
Well, I did not want to miss my connection.
So you said. But, mademoiselle, the Orient Express leaves Stamboul every day of the week. Even if you had missed a connection, it would only have been a matter of 24 hours' delay.
Miss Debenham, for the first time, showed signs of losing her temper.
You do not seem to realize that one may have friends awaiting one's arrival in London, and that a day's delay upsets arrangements and causes a lot of annoyance.
Ah, it is like that. There are friends awaiting your arrival. You do not want to cause them inconvenience?
Naturally.
And yet it is curious.
Well, what is curious?
On this train, again, we have a delay. And this time a more serious delay, since there is no possibility of sending a telegram to your friends or of getting them on the long distance?
The telephone, you mean?
Ah, yes, the portmanteau call, as you say in England.
Mary Debenham smiled a little in spite of herself.
Trunk call,
she corrected.
Yes, as you say, it is extremely annoying not to be able to get any word through, either by telephone or telegraph.
And yet, mademoiselle, this time, your manner is quite different. You no longer betray the impatience. You are calm and philosophical. Hmm?
Mary Debenham flushed and bit her lip. She no longer felt inclined to smile.
You do not answer, mademoiselle?
I'm sorry, I did not know there was anything to answer.
The explanation of your change of attitude, mademoiselle.
Well, don't you think that you're making rather a fuss about nothing, Monsieur Poirot?
Poirot spread out his hands in an apologetic gesture.
It is perhaps a fault with us detectives. We expect the behaviour to be always consistent. We do not allow for changes of mood.
Mary Debenham made no reply.
You know Colonel Arbuthnot well, mademoiselle?
He fancied that she was relieved by the change of subject.
I met him for the first time on this journey.
Ah, and have you any reason to suspect that he may have known this man Ratchet?
She shook her head decisively.
Oh, no, I'm quite sure he didn't.
Why are you sure?
Well, by the way he spoke.
And yet, mademoiselle, we found a pipe cleaner on the floor of the dead man's compartment. And Colonel Arbuthnot is the only man on the train who smokes a pipe?
He watched her narrowly, but she displayed neither surprise nor emotion. Merely said,
Nonsense. It's absurd. Colonel Arbuthnot is the last man in the world to be mixed up in a crime, especially a theatrical kind of crime like this.
It was so much what Poirot himself thought that he found himself on the point of agreeing with her. He said instead,
I must remind you that you do not know him very well, mademoiselle.
She shrugged her shoulders.
Well, I know the type well enough.
He said very gently,
You still refuse to tell me the meaning of those words, when it's behind us?
She said coldly,
I have nothing more to say.
Oh, well, it does not matter,
said Hercule Poirot.
I shall find out.
He bowed and left the compartment, closing the door behind him.
Was that wise, my friend? Asked Monsieur Bouc. You have put her on her guard, eh? And through her you have put the colonel on his guard also. Mon ami, if you wish to catch a rabbit, you put a ferret into the hole. And if the rabbit is there, he runs. That is all I have done.
They entered the compartment of Hildegard Schmidt. The woman was standing in readiness, her face respectful but unemotional. Poirot took a quick glance through the contents of the small case on the seat. Then he motioned to the attendant to get down the bigger suitcase from the rack.
"The keys?" he said.
"It is not locked, monsieur."
Poirot undid the hasps and lifted the lid.
"Aha!"
he said, and turning to Monsieur Bouc, "You remember what I said?
Look here a little moment, hein?"
On top of the suitcase was a hastily rolled-up brown Wagon Lee uniform. The stolidity of the German woman underwent a sudden change.
"Ah!" she cried. "That is not mine. I did not put it there. I have never looked in that case since we left Stamboul. Indeed, indeed, it is true."
She looked from one to another pleadingly. Poirot took her gently by the arm and soothed her.
"No, no, no. All is well. We believe you. Don't be agitated. I am as sure you did not hide the uniform there as I am sure that you are a good cook. See, you are a good cook, are you not?"
Bewildered, the woman smiled in spite of herself.
"Yes, indeed. All my ladies have said so.
She stopped, her mouth open, looking frightened again.
"No, no, no," said Poirot. "I assure you all is well. See, I will tell you how this happened. This man, the man you saw in Wagon Lee uniform, comes out of the dead man's compartment, huh? He collides with you. Now that is bad luck for him. He has hoped that no one will see him. What to do next? He must get rid of his uniform. It is now not a safeguard, but a danger."
His glance went to Monsieur Bouc and Dr. Constantine, who were listening attentively.
"There is the snow, you see. The snow which confuses all his plans. Where can he hide these clothes, eh? All the compartments are full? No. He passes one where the door is open and shows it to be unoccupied. It must be the one belonging to the woman with whom he has just collided. He slips in, removes the uniform, and jams it hurriedly into a suitcase on the rack. It may be some time before it is discovered."
"And then?"
said Monsieur Bouc.
"Well, that we must discuss,"
said Poirot with a warning glance. He held up the tunic. A button, the third down, was missing. Poirot slipped his hand into the pocket and took out a conductor's pass key, used to unlock the doors of the compartments.
"Here is the explanation of how our man was able to pass through locked doors," said Monsieur Bouc. "Your questions to Mrs. Hubbard were unnecessary. Locked or not locked, the man could easily get through the communicating door. After all, if a Wagon Lee uniform, why not a Wagon Lee key?"
"Why not, indeed?" said Poirot.
"Well, we might have known it, really. You remember Michel said that the door into the corridor of Mrs. Hubbard's compartment was locked when he came in to answer her to her bell.
That is so, monsieur," said the conductor. "That is why I thought the lady must have been dreaming."
"Yeah, but now it is easy," continued Monsieur Bouc. "Doubtless he meant to relock the communicating door also, but perhaps he heard some movement from the bed, and it startled him."
"We have now," said Poirot, "only to find the scarlet kimono."
True. And these last two compartments are occupied by men.
But we will search all the same."
"Oh, assuredly. Besides, I remember what you said,
Hector McQueen acquiesced willingly in the search.
"Well, I'd just as soon you did," he said with a rueful smile. "I feel I'm just definitely the most suspicious character on the train. You've only got to find a will in which the old man left me all his money, and that'll just about fix things."
Monsieur Bouc bent a suspicious glance upon him.
Well, that's just my fun,"
said McQueen hastily.
"He'd never have left me a cent, really. No, I was just useful to him, you know, languages and so on.
You're up to be done down, you know, if you don't speak anything but good American. I'm no linguist myself, but I know what I call shopping and hotel snappy bits in French and German and Italian."
His voice was a little louder than usual. It was as though he was slightly uneasy at the search, in spite of his willingness. Poirot emerged.
"Nothing," he said. "Not even a compromising bequest."
McQueen sighed. "Well, that's a load off my mind," he said humorously.
They moved on to the last compartment. The examination of the luggage of the big Italian and of the valet yielded no result. The three men stood at the end of the coach looking at each other.
Well, what next? Asked Monsieur Bouc.
Well, we will go back to the dining car, said Poirot. We know now all that we can know. Where are the evidence of the passengers, the evidence of their baggage, the evidence of our eyes. We can expect no further help. It must be our part now to use our brains.
He felt in his pocket for his cigarette case. It was empty.
I will join you in a moment, he said. I shall need the cigarettes. Ah, this is a very difficult and very curious affair. Who wore that scarlet kimono, eh? Where is it now? Oh, I wish I knew. There is something in this case, some factor that escapes me. It is difficult because it has been made difficult, but we will discuss it. Pardon me a moment.
He went hurriedly along the corridor to his own compartments. He had, he knew, a further supply of cigarettes in one of his valises. He got it down and snapped back the lock. Then he sat back on his heels and stared. Neatly folded on the top of the case was a thin scarlet silk kimono embroidered with dragons.
So, he murmured, it is like that, eh? A defiance. Very well. I take it up.
Part 3. Hercule Poirot sits back and thinks. Chapter 1. Which of them? Monsieur Bouc and Dr. Constantine were talking together when Poirot entered the dining car. Monsieur Bouc was looking depressed.
Oh, le voilà,
said the latter when he saw Poirot. And then he added, as his friend sat down,
If you solve this case, mon cher, I shall indeed believe in miracles.
Oh, it worries you, this case?
Oh, naturally it worries me. I cannot make head or tail of it.
I agree, said the doctor. He looked at Poirot with interest. To be frank, he said, I cannot see what you are going to do next.
No,
said Poirot thoughtfully. He took out his cigarette case and lit one of his tiny cigarettes. His eyes were dreamy.
That, to me, is the interest of this case, he said. We are cut off from all the normal routes of procedure. Are these people whose evidence we have taken speaking the truth or lying? No, we have no means of finding out except such means as we can devise ourselves. It is an exercise, this, of the brain.
That is all very fine, said Monsieur Bouc. But what have you to go upon?
Well, I told you just now, we have the evidence of the passengers and the evidence of our own eyes.
Pretty evidence, that of the passengers. It told us just nothing at all.
Poirot shook his head.
I do not agree, my friend.
The evidence of the passengers gave us several points of interest.
Indeed, said Monsieur Bouc skeptically. I did not observe it.
Ah, but that is because you did not listen.
Well, tell me, what did I miss? I will just take one instance. The first evidence we heard, that of the young McQueen. He uttered, to my mind, one very significant phrase.
What, about the letters?
No, not about the letters. As far as I can remember, his words were, we travelled about, Monsieur Ratchet wanted to see the world. He was hampered by knowing no languages. I acted more as a courier than a secretary.
He looked from the doctor's face to that of Monsieur Bouc.
What? You still do not see? Now that is inexcusable, for you had a second chance again just now when he said, you're apt to be done down if you speak nothing but good American.
You mean...
Monsieur Bouc still looked puzzled.
Ah, it is that you want it given to you in words of one syllable? Well, here it is. Monsieur Ratchet spoke no French. Ha-ha! Yet, when the conductor came in to answer to his bell last night, it was a voice speaking in French that told him that it was a mistake and that he was not wanted. It was, moreover, a perfectly idiomatic phrase that was used. Not one that a man knowing only a few words of French would have selected. Ce n'est rien, je me suis trompé.